be just a little bit unpleasant. Don't move. Stay very still now. Don't talk.
How long does this take?
Not long.
All right, this is Valley Forge, Berkshire, Sequoia. Valley Forge, Berkshire, Sequoia.
This is Tom Central. Channel open for Executive Order AUC-3423.
Listen to this, boys.
Now, where are my people? 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 Where are my people?
Dr. Haber, what are we supposed to do here?
We're going to work together. We're going to build a relationship. You're going to let me inside, poke around, find out what's causing those bad dreams of yours.
When we are with you, as we are with you now, there is nothing, nothing that we are more focused upon than that which you are. But simultaneously, like the wave of a radio, we are focused into nothingness. We are focused into all things contemplated. There is a radio station broadcasting radio frequency. There are many radios, and the music or the voice is equally received by all of them.
Night shift.
That is the way we are focused upon you. But we do not worry. We are not bound by thought. Because when we are not with you, we love you, but we don't think of you.
think there's no place to hide.
Mondays, midnight, here on Listener Sponsored Radio, WBAI.
Are you there?
Where life is like science fiction.
Talking about it, and I have no idea. I have no idea. I have no idea why I'm here. I don't know what I'm doing, you know, talking about this. I saw something, they saw something. There was a lot of light. That's all I know.
Now, where are my people? The 70 billion people of Earth, where are they hiding?
Fascinating.
Second of all, and this is a very important reason, to dig the people. The people in jazz nightclubs are the funniest.
You are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, 99.5 FM, and I'm actually joined in the studio by Joe Masseri.
Good evening, Mr. Sergeant.
Joe Masseri, and Chris, I think that's you on the phone? Is that you, Chris?
Yes.
Well, this is a very interesting show we're going to have this evening.
Because Joe's here.
No, not because Joe's here. Joe's here because it's so interesting. We have a very special guest this morning.
Now I'm excited.
Yes.
And it's not Chris Taylor either.
And it's not Chris Taylor. We have the very famous, very prolific, very interesting, very fascinating, as Spock would say, writer Norman Spinrad.
In studio.
In studio. The author of Bug Jack Baron, The Iron World.
Deus Ex.
So many great.
And his latest novel.
And his latest novel. And we're going to talk about that.
Yes, we are.
Osama the Gun. And for those who don't read science fiction, you may know him from Star Trek. Chris?
Yeah.
Do you know who Norman Spinrad is?
Mike, we went and went to his house.
That's right, you were there. That's right, you, me, and Tony. That's right, you, me, and Tony went to visit Norman Spinrad. That's how long I've known Norman Spinrad. I forgot you were there, Chris.
Wow. Yeah.
I forgot you
were there. Actually, was it Tony or just me and you, I think?
No, it was definitely Tony.
Was Tony was there? Yeah.
Tony was definitely
loved
there.
His house.
Well,
Pete Laurie's old house.
Well, we are going to have Norman Spinrad here live in the studio, talking about his new novel, talking about the state of science fiction, talking about
the
science
state of
fiction
publishing,
e-books, all of that, and just what is going on in the world of science fiction.
What the heck?
So, stay tuned.
We'll be right back.
Do you recognize any of this music, Joseph Missouri?
This is very sad music.
It's very sad music. Right, I'm going to play the track that you should know. Any true aficionado would know this.
Well, only because Mr. Spinrad is sitting here, I would say it's Star Trek music, but...
You're right. It is. Norman Spinrad, how are you?
I'm doing okay.
How have you been?
Up and down, up and down.
Okay. Well,
down and around.
Down and around. Well, I would have to say, Chris is on the phone, and I didn't realize that Chris had come with me. It's got to be like 20 years ago now that I came to visit you out in California.
Yeah, at least, because I was living in Paris. Yeah, it's got to be longer than that, because
longer
I was
than
living
that.
In Paris for 15 years.
Right.
After that.
Right, wow. Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. It was easily late 80s, early 90s. And
We couldn't have been here.
It was 91, maybe? 91?
That would have to be earlier than that.
Norman, I think it was 80. I think it was 89, Mike.
That might be right.
Alrighty, maybe it was, because you did leave shortly after. Within a year, you left after that. Well, I have very, very fond memories, because going to science fiction conventions, one of the best things about going is getting to meet authors whose books and worlds and imagination you've been lost in. And the music that you're listening to is from Star Trek, the episode called The Doomsday Machine, which is the one that Norman wrote. And I, you know, just meeting you from that, having, at that point, I think I'd already read Bug Jack Baron and at least three or four other novels that you had written. So here's my first question to you, Norman. What, at this point in your career as a science fiction writer, what inspires you to want to write? What makes you want to write? What kind of things go on that make you want to write?
Oh, it depends. Each book is an individual thing. The last book, Osama the Gun, was inspired to begin with, I suppose, by being in New York right at 9/11.
Okay.
I mean, very close.
Very science fiction-y.
And I was coming, Don and I had gone to Philadelphia for the Worldcon. Then I went down to see my mother in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. No, at Boca Raton. I was coming back at the Fort Lauderdale airport. Everything was screwed up. But this is on September 10th. Everything was screwed up, so I called Donna. I was there for hours. And she says, why don't you just go back to your mother's place and come back to New York tomorrow? And somebody says, no, I'm not leaving until I get out of here.
Okay.
So I got back to New York around midnight on the 10th, went to sleep, looked up in the morning out the window onto 6th Avenue.
Now, where was this exactly, 6th Avenue?
9th Street and 6th Avenue.
Wow, okay.
And saw all this crowd on the street. I said to Donna, what's all that? And she said, they're always shooting movies around here. Because you couldn't...
Okay.
And then I called my agent to make an appointment, and I'm told, he's not going to be here because of what happened. I said, what happened? They tell me what happened. I run down there, and there it is. And so I was in the semi-restricted zone for like, I don't know, a week, and the frenzy and the whole thing, and it got me into the whole business of that, and I wrote two pieces about it for Libération, which is a French national newspaper, and people kept asking me for years, well, why don't you write something about 9/11? And a lot of people were writing stuff about 9/11, but it was like their reactions to it. There was that kind of stuff, and I said, I'm not writing about this because I don't know what to write about it yet. And the stuff that people are writing about it is, you know, sort of lint in their own navels and psychological thing. And finally, I got the idea to write a short story from the point of view of a jihadi, a young jihadi, and I got about 20 or 30 pages into it when I realized I started a novel. So that's how that one happened. I just went on and I realized it's going to be a very hard thing to sell, because it was basically a kind of sympathy for the devil thing. And so I knew I would have to write this thing without a contract, without anything, and see what happened afterwards. So that's one.
Okay.
Then the novel I wrote after that was I've always been interested in dreams and the relationship between dreams and the creator state of consciousness.
Okay.
So, I got an idea to write a novel that was the basic science fiction premise being that somebody invents a machine that's like a chip player, like a DVD player, only it's dream chips, and you put the stuff on your head and you buy dreams.
Okay.
For the purpose of this, so that the bulk of the book, almost all of the book, would be taking place in dreams. And the viewpoint character would be the person reading the book.
Okay.
No one else.
Okay.
And that meant that the whole thing had to be written in second person, singular. Nobody's ever done anything like that. Editors, particularly David Hartwell, who I respected, said, "You're crazy. You can't do that. You can't possibly make that work." I didn't know whether I could or I couldn't. I didn't want to get a contract to write the thing because I didn't know whether I could fulfill it or not. So what I started doing over a period of 2 or 3 years, I guess, was writing the dream scenarios and seeing if I could sell them, get them published in magazines as independent short stories, for the most part, without telling the editors what this was all about, just as freestanding independent short stories. And in fact, I sold 6 of them to 6 different places.
Wow.
And that's called Welcome to Your Dream Time, which has not been published anywhere yet.
Wow. Now, you know, I have to say, preparing for this, because I know you personally, and, you know, again, I after you know someone, you know, you in a way, you kind of don't distance yourself from their work. So I went back and I'm doing all this research. You have always sort of broken tradition. And what's interesting is I was looking, and you probably have seen this, but in Bug Jack Baron, probably your most well-known work, there are a number of things that we have today that you had different names for, but that you predicted. So I'm just curious, how strong an influence do you think science fiction has on reality? Do you think it influences it?
Well, I think it's a feedback loop. For instance, In a World Between, which was published in 79 or something like that, I invented the internet.
Right. Well, you had
before
cell phones.
Before Al Gore. You know.
Well, you had mini phones in Bug Jack Baron in 1969.
Yeah. Now we've got them.
Cell phones, right.
Same thing with Gibson and cyberspace.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, if you predict enough things, some of them are going to come out right. Some of them aren't. The point is not to predict things. The point is to
see where things will go.
See where things can go, where things can go, where they might go. And then you do have an influence on reality. With A World Between, for example, I was in France before I wrote that, and there were 3 radio stations and 3 television stations, all government. And I did a lot of promotion for that book in France. Which is also about electronic democracy. Well, I come back 2 years later, and they have liberated the airwaves. Now, how much I had to do with that, I don't know, but probably something. So it's really a feedback situation.
That's interesting, right? So you see what's happening influences you to have ideas, and then those ideas influence what's happening.
Everything, yeah. But I mean, I have no particular speaking of Welcome to Your Dream Time, I really believe for a long time that somehow, and this is also part of He Walked Among Us, which is the last book to be published here, I believe that somehow that the dreaming state, which we all experience, is somehow the same thing in a kind of way as a creative state. Which many people experience. And I've done experiments with this, and I think that's part of where things come from. I'd call it the creative unconsciousness, call it the creative consciousness, call it the dream time. There is some common something where that comes from, and where ideas come from, or impetus for a novel comes from, or for a short story, is something below the level of rational thought, at least the initial impetus. And when it isn't, you get something like postmodern fiction, where people don't really have a story to tell or a true inspiration, so they intellectualize something. Mm-hmm. And mostly, that's not very good.
No. A level just beneath rational thinking.
Well, maybe pretty far beneath. It's not, I don't know if it's beneath, it's different. It's where, mm-hmm. it's where things get processed in a deeper level, in a more in an unconscious level, depending on what kind of metaphors or ideologies you choose to put on it, where what happens to you gets processed. Because also for me, science fiction, whatever that is, speculative fiction, what's unique about it is it's ultimately, I mean, good stuff, is about the interface and the feedback relationship between the external surround, the total thing, the world you're in, and your and the interior consciousness of the characters. And that is directly what, say, He Walked Among Us is about, even though it's very serious, but it's a comic novel too. And it's a big part of it is about that process, that interface, that feedback loop.
All right, well, now this to me sets up a little bit of the context of your publishing your novel and having to take the route that you did and what's available to us now. So I want to talk to you a little bit about ebooks, but I also want to talk to you about what has happened over the last 30 years to published science fiction. I mean, what's your take on it? As in my opinion, one of the most esteemed, you know, well-known science fiction authors, there aren't that many you hear of nowadays. Maybe most people could name a handful.
Yeah, and it's usually Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury, and Robert Heinlein,
exactly,
and maybe Bill Gibson. Yeah.
Exactly. It wasn't like that 30 years ago, 20
well,
years ago.
Well, it wasn't like that 20 years ago, but maybe it was like that 30 or 40 years ago.
Okay.
You know, what goes up must come down, said Wernher von Braun. Another science fiction was a kind of pulp literature, a kind of juvenile literature regarded as that up until the 60s, where there was a creative explosion,
mm-hmm.
and the publishing changed and became a serious literature. Bug Jack Baron was one of the instrumental things that adult, politically engaged, sexually engaged, and so forth, science fiction. And it went for a long period, about 10 or 15 years, on the rise. And then it was sort of artificially bumped up even further by Star Trek and Star Wars,
mm-hmm.
Particularly Star Trek, which introduced the metaphors and the tropes of science fiction to a mass audience.
Mm-hmm.
The original Star Trek never had good ratings,
mm-hmm.
had lousy ratings, but lousy ratings meant that 25 million people
right.
a week were seeing right. the thing, right. which was unprecedented.
Well, go ahead.
And then that stuff took over. Star Wars, Star Trek, all that stuff, it became, the media tires and stuff became dominant. And from that, it became, in effect, media tie-ins without a media to tie them in. And a vast tsunami of schlock, which started, which buried serious science fiction up to a point. But again, it's another feedback loop, because the culture at the same time was becoming skeptical about science, skeptical about technology, technophobic, and fantasy started to take over from science fiction, and that became more and more schlock.
That's where we are right now.
And that's where we are right now.
Right now, we're deep in this fantasy taking over. And it's interesting now, I'm curious your take, because I see a lot of irony here. On the one hand, you know, you look at any box office chart, the most money-making films of all time have always been science fiction or fantasy. You know, with the exception of children's, and a lot of times those are some kind of fantasy. And at the same time, there are tons and tons of science fiction TV series throughout the 90s. We had an amazing amount. In the 21st century, they have this thing where they, it's a science fiction, but they don't market it as science fiction. It's Lost. It's, you know, Heroes. It's something else. It's pretty much science fiction, but they don't call it that. Sci-Fi Channel rebrands itself as Sci-Fi so as not to be...
I don't know why they did that. I mean, it might have been some kind of lawsuit by the Ackerman estate. I don't know.
No, it says the same thing. It was a rebranding, believe me.
Well, it was a rebranding, but why?
Supposedly, and again, there was a lot of debate about it, but supposedly because they didn't want to alienate those who don't like science fiction. Now, to me, that's so ludicrous considering how popular science fiction
is. The point is what has happened in the culture at large is that people have lost the distinction between science fiction and
sci-fi.
Between science and I'm going to say something I shouldn't say. Between science and mysticism and malarkey. I mean, you just had Michelle Bachman say that. That the earthquake and the hurricane were God's way of telling us that our budget was out of whack. She really said this crap. Rick Perry says, "Well, I don't believe it. He doesn't believe in the theory of evolution, just a theory." People don't really, at large, don't quite get the difference between astronomy and astrology. So it's a feedback loop. The cultural position that science fiction had that was to some extent speaking to people about future oriented evolution, like evolutionary society, has been overcome by that sort of thing at the same time that the space program is dying.
I think that says a lot too.
Yeah, at the same time that we have a golden age of astronomy, fantastic, very fast discoveries being made, the space program is over.
If I may, the American space program.
The Chinese are just starting, and the Russians are still going.
The director of the planetarium at the American Museum of Planetarium was on a talk show recently, and he was among other political guests. And basically, he was talking about the overall state of things and the reason why the space program had been left to basically die without a public outcry. And basically, you know, he said, when you think about the age that the space program came up in, mm-hmm. it was that sense of wonder. You know, we were going to travel to Mars, and Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers, and, you know, this whole thing of American patriotism and wonder and a chance to dream and to do something great and a hope for a better tomorrow, which is all gone now, basically. That society, with everything that's going on, is so downcast and downtrodden. It's about living in the moment and not creating, you know, the world's fair and the world of tomorrow. Kind of thing has all kind of disappeared from the zeitgeist.
Yeah, but again, it's a feedback loop because it's science fiction that speculative fiction in general that performed the function of keeping that sort of thing alive in a society. And on the other hand, if the society is interested in that kind of thing, it sort of dies in the literature too. One of the things I haven't written a book yet because I haven't figured it out yet. Would be a historical about the admiral, Chinese admiral Zheng He and the emperor Zhu Di. In the 15th century, China was a couple of centuries ahead of the West technologically. They had movable type mass. They printed a quarter of a million copies of novels then, which you try and get out now. They were centuries ahead of the West.
Point being
that for political reasons, and they sent these vast flotillas of merchant ships and stuff, hundreds of ships. They got as far. They documented unquestionably got as far as Africa. Maybe they got to the Americas and so on and so forth. And then for political and economic reasons, it was stopped. And they haven't recovered since. They lost the idea, the concept of a dynamically evolving culture in a technological sense. Something which has only evolved on this planet twice. Once in China, and once in the Industrial Revolution in Europe, and nowhere else, never like that. And the Chinese stopped. And it took them centuries to recover from this. And that's where we're beginning to approach now.
Right, where they're headed back to being this.
And the reason is because people have lost the concept of the future being better than the present. And there's something we can do about it. I always say that, you know, the future we get is the future we make.
So you think now, and I have to pause you there, because and I think it's somewhat profound. You see, you think our preponderance of, as Joe said, ruminating on this downtrodden, the end of the world, and 2012, and all of this, we're just kind of speeding ourselves towards this future that we keep imagining and keep seeing and keep making movies and stories about?
Well, a few, maybe 10 years ago, I realized I've been pursuing an overall theme in a lot of stuff I'm writing, which I call the transformation crisis. And that is, has to evolve in the history of any sapient species anywhere in the universe, a transformation crisis where the species develops the possibility of destroying its planet one way or another, nuclear weapons, runaway climate catastrophe, and so on and so forth. Or it evolves a stable, dynamically evolving technology and culture so that it will last millions of years. On this planet, maybe it started with Hiroshima and so forth. We're right in the middle of it now, and it's very much in doubt. It will probably be very much in doubt for another 100 years at least. And I think that is where we are right now. I don't think it's related to one election in one country or anything like that. It is a cultural crisis that is inevitable in the history of any sapient species anywhere. It's inherent. When we transcend, for better or for worse, natural evolution. That's over. The idiots are in charge of the asylum, like it or not.
That's unfortunately true. Now let me ask you now, taking all that context, what has this done specifically to science fiction publishing? And how dramatically has that changed in the last 15 years?
Well, that's a big story, but one of the things had little to do with science fiction publishing per se, and that is another thing that's happening in the entire economy at large, is conglomeratization. What you got now is four publishing companies that own almost all the major imprints that used to be independent. So it's run by number crunchers now. When companies get that big, the people on the top, and this doesn't just go for publishing, are number crunchers and economics people who are not really that involved with the product. Editors don't have power really anymore. It's number people. One of the reasons I'm writing a book which was shortly going to go to New Orleans to research called Police State about future thing. It's not what you think it is. It's about Louisiana in the near future, where the police become the revolutionary outfit for various reasons. And I had an editor at a publishing house who really wanted to buy it, but said he could never get it through his publishing committee. So too bad.
I understand.
Wouldn't even bother present it. Because my numbers were lousy on the last book. And it's all number crunching now.
Well, before you leave tonight, remember, I have a publisher for you. Told him about you, and he's like, he cannot believe that you're not being so this. But I don't want to get ahead of myself. So now, in all this context, and I'll ask you a slight side question. You know, since you invented the internet, where is it going with net neutralization, net neutrality, and you know all the commoditization of the internet and everything? Everything has an ad now. There's a pop up on everything. Where's the internet going? And what about that as another means of...
Well, I think it's going in a lot of different directions at once. I mean, you look at China, where they're really trying to control it, but they really can't. The technology can't be controlled that easily. It can be used in various ways. It can certainly be commercialized. You can have things like Facebook, where they're really getting data and selling databases of people's stuff. But it's too diffuse to go in any one direction at once, I think.
Okay.
Even in China, they really have really good technology to control it, but it's not good enough.
There's still ways.
On the other hand, you could also say that, after all, what the hell is the internet really? It's sight. It's sound. Why, it's television.
It's interactive television. TV.
It's interactive
exactly
television.
Like, that's what it is.
And stuff like, I think, the iPad.
iPad.
The iPad is really ominous because these tablets are basically in the process, to some extent, of transforming the internet into another kind of commercial television. These things are basically for consuming media and not for creating it. You can't write on the thing. You can't write music on it. You know, it's turning it into television.
I have to throw another piece of irony. If you look, there's a great poster for 2001: A Space Odyssey, and like they're all on the moon, and there's a guy standing there and he's holding an iPad.
Wow.
If you look at that poster,
but
so
everybody's walking around with advertising under their arm, basically.
Well, it's also product placement in
exactly.
So I think it's going in a lot of different directions at once. It's really hard to say where it's going to go.
All right, well,
just like television.
Well, sure, Norman. Yeah. If I may, one of the things that I think is really scary about it, as we go from when media was like this through newspapers, radios, televisions, and now iPads, where we now have it working in a blinder sense, and we have the individuals in a very very centralized, decommunitized environment being
decommunitized.
The community is gone.
Okay.
They're now focused and getting information streams by the media. Then now the media has even more control of the mindset of the individual by disenfranchising him from everyone else and not allowing us to communicate.
Well, it doesn't, because what they're really doing, especially with news, is kind of preaching to the converted. People, you know, when you had network television, the three networks, you know, Walter Cronkite and Tom Brokaw and all that stuff, everybody was sort of seeing the same major news stories every night. Mm-hmm. Now it's put in different boxes. It's like fandoms. You have Fox fandom, you have NBC fandom, you have CNN fandom, and people are getting what they want to see. People are choosing what they want to see.
And that's what I was going to bring in. Everybody has the illusion of choice now, you know, and the illusion of choice.
It's not an illusion.
Well, it's an illusion in the sense that are you getting anything that's really that different than what you're getting on CNN? Is it really that different than what you're getting on
Fox?
Well, I mean, I guess it's for the taste.
Yeah, it's different.
Okay.
Different.
Well, you know, I guess it depends on how you look at it because I don't watch TV, so it's all the same.
Well, I mean, in other words, you get radical,
right?
I mean, you get Christian networks, can get left wing networks, right wing, but you don't get you could avoid contact with the ideologies or the cultures that you don't like and don't believe in. You don't get it thrown at your face as part of a general multicultural mix. You can, you can
stay narrow-minded,
and you're
forever.
Encouraged to stay in your narrow box like that.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, you see what's happening to the Republican Party. It's become a bughouse. You have one candidate crazier than the next, but one of these nuts is going probably to be nominated for president of the United States. People who really should be put away somewhere. They're crazy.
I hear you. All right, now,
let me ask you two quick questions. Let me take you out of this now. Let's go back into your life. A question that Mike always likes to ask and haven't asked yet, but when did you know that you wanted to be a storyteller?
Oh, I don't know. I started doing a little bit of that in when I was like 13 or 14, writing little things in notebooks. But earlier on than that, when I was a little kid, I was into puppets and doing like puppet theater stuff. I made a little puppet theater and made up little stories and stuff like that.
I used to do the same thing. It's so funny. I used to have puppet shows for the whole block.
Yeah, I used to do puppets. So that was really early on. When I knew I was really wanted to actually pursue this as a career was sometime probably in college. And after that, I got into law school and stuff like that. I really didn't want to do that. Parental pressure, all that stuff. Spent 2 months in Mexico on the cheap and came back deciding, no, I'm not going to go to law school. I'm going to try and make it as a writer. And that's sort of how it started. So I can't really say point to one defining moment, no.
All right, well, here's what I want to ask now. Getting back to all this context in the world that we're in, and where we've been and where we are. The ebook, what's your take on the ebook in general? And then tell me about making this decision to publish that way.
Well, that's a big story. First of all, I'm also a reviewer. And everywhere I've lived, how big the house is, whatever, it gets overrun by paper books. And, and I can't bear, finally I start throwing some of this crap out. But, the whole idea of burning, I had fireplaces. Burn books.
Did you burn books?
Finally, I burned books a little bit, but I really couldn't burn books. In L.A., I had books, the Dangerous Vision bookstore. I could trade books for other books, but New York, I couldn't do that. I just inundated with books. So I'm all in favor of e-books. I think e-books are the future, aside from the ecological benefit of not cutting down all those trees. From my point of view, not having a house full of this stuff, I think, and each year the percentage of e-books that are the percentage of all books being sold is doubling. I don't think paper books are going to disappear completely, but the mass market paperback will.
Mm.
So I'm all in favor of that. The business model gets very, very complicated now. It's a very chaotic situation. I've been self-publishing my backlist first because it's almost impossible to get backlist published in paper now for the simple reason that over the last almost a century, how many science fiction novels have been published? And the rack space is limited in the stores, so it's very hard to get this your backlist, keep it in print. And there's a thing called Thor Power Tool Decisions, which is a tax thing, which means they have to trash their inventory every year. So they, even if they're selling a few thousand copies, they can't keep it in a warehouse. If they want to bring it back into print, they got to print a minimum of 10,000 books, which to sell in a year. So the e-books are reviving the backlist. They will I put these books on Amazon and Barnes and Noble. They will never disappear. They'll always be there.
Mm.
And whatever money I make off them, I'm making off them. But so because of Osama the Gun, which was a book that I knew as I was writing it would be very, very, very hard to sell because it was told from the point of view, first person point of view, of a kind of innocent young jihadi from the reborn caliphate who stepwise becomes a revolutionary in France, sort of not really violent, then through various serendipitous happenings, becomes a legendary icon of the jihadi trade and so on and so forth, and does these very bad things, but with a good, clean heart. He's a sincere Muslim. He learns a lot on the Hajj. It's a whole section on the Hajj. He gets involved in a war in Nigeria where the Americans are using complete drone and also ground drone weaponry to fight a second Biafra revolution because they want to get at the oil, and they're using the Biafran Christians as gun fodder and backing them up with drones, a little bit more complicated than what they have now, but not by much. And this was written before any of this. So I knew, and I would even, but it's also sympathetic to Islam as opposed to Islamic terrorism, which is not the same thing. And that's why this character, Osama, who is not Osama bin Laden, but in this near future, Osama is the second most popular Arabic name after Muhammad, is good-hearted kid who is, and a sincere Muslim who stepwise gets involved in this and gets his consciousness twisted to the point where he does terrible things for idealistic good reasons. And the Americans are doing Biafra what they have now done
for effort
in Libya.
Gotcha.
Drones and in Afghanistan. And this is where, in fact, American military technology is going right now. So I knew this thing would be very, very hard to publish. My French publisher has published it. So finally, because I just couldn't get it sold here, I was told by one publisher in a rejection slip, no American publisher will touch a thing like this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I had the same thing with Jack Baron. We can't publish this thing. No American public foaming at the mouth, but that's one of the reasons I had to do it, because people are foaming at the mouth about this kind of thing. And I was trying, and this is to present, a more rounded picture. And so finally, when I couldn't find, a publisher here for it, I decided to self-publish it on the internet to see what would happen. I had varying modest success with the backlist stuff. Nobody had ever tried to launch a major
new work.
Like this. It's an experiment, and it's still an experiment in progress. Not doing too well right now, but it's only been on there a month. But one thing I've already learned is which I should have known to begin with. Well, how do you get a thing reviewed when there are no galleys and there are no paper books to send? Well, you can maybe send people an un-DRM PDF,
right.
But then you're afraid that the thing is going to get pirated.
Right.
It's really it's a problem with that. I don't know what the answer is for that. So it has not been reviewed anywhere as far as I know. I've started to carefully send out a few review copies like this to people I know and trust, not to let it fall into the hands of the pirates. Because I got to say one thing, some of the older backlist books that I got on there
are out pirated.
Were pirated. I pirated the pirates.
You pirated the pirates?
I pirated the pirates, yeah.
And then you put it out yourself.
And then I put it out myself.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Now, wait. So now the book, it's Osama the Gun, and is it right on Amazon? Is it on?
It's on Amazon, and it's on Barnes & Noble.
Okay.
The reason it isn't anywhere else is I don't want it anywhere else. Because this gives me the ability to pull it off when I want to, and I've only committed to putting it on there through October. Because the other thing that's happening in publishers is a huge fight between the writers and the publishers, the paper publishers, over who controls the ebook rights and how the money is split. It's a deal killer. If you can't give them if you won't give them the ebook rights, they won't publish the book. So in order to sell this book,
I have to
be able to pull it and sell it. Yeah,
sell the rights.
I
hope I can help you with that. Well, now two more things. Now you told me within the first week of doing this, something very interesting happened.
Yeah, I had checked this book pretty carefully. You know, I mean, it's a lot of work. It's kind of dicey taking something you've written in RTF or Doc or something and turning it into EPUB and MOBI and stuff like that. But I have software where I can look at what I did. I know it was okay. Thing goes on, and there's a so-called review on Amazon about how this thing should be pulled immediately because it's full of errors. It's unreadable. And I got somebody else said, no, that's, you know, I checked it out. It wasn't true. But somehow that has hurt the sales of it, I think.
And it's out there.
It's out there because.
So anybody can just put up any.
Oh, those reviews. Yeah.
Review and you can't pull it down even if
you can't pull down a review.
You can or you can't.
You can't. And the reviews are often anonymous or pseudonymous. There are also some scandalous stuff coming out about how people are paying people to do this.
Of course,
these things are not reviews. It's really something I can't say on radio. Yeah, it's one of those call-in words. But yeah, I mean, so that's, you know, and it's like when people tell a big lie. It's very hard to catch up with it. People believe the first thing they read.
Sure.
So
they don't read the retraction.
So I don't think the guy had read the thing. I think this was a deliberate sabotage attempt. And the book being what it is, it's hard to say whether it was a sabotage attempt on the part of jihadis or on the part of right-wing, gun-toting, good old boy, Americans.
What if it was a jilted girlfriend?
A what? A joke?
No, a jilted girlfriend, I said.
It could be a jilted girlfriend. It could be a hired gun. It could be anything.
Mm.
And that's one of the other problems with ebooks. There's no real place to go for reviews that you can trust. You can't trust the stuff on Amazon or Barnes and Noble. It's self-serving stuff. You can write your own thing under a pseudonym. You can have your friends write it. You can It's not real reviewing.
See it with the iPhone apps all the time. People write like 20 in the same day.
With Barnes & Noble, as somebody who reviews and the book reviews that I post on Fears Mag, mm-hmm. I can go on Barnes & Noble without buying anything, and I can post a review or link to review. Amazon, you have to sign up, and then you have to have made a couple of purchases before they will let you post your reviews.
Really?
Yes.
Sure.
That's interesting. That's interesting.
But you can purchase but the review can still be under a pseudonym.
Wow. Well, we've been speaking with Norman Spinrad, who is the author of, among many books, a new book called Osama the Gun, which is an e-book, which is currently available on Barnes & Noble and Amazon.
Only through October. Well, maybe. I don't know. It's an experiment.
Okay. And the other book, the Dream Book?
It's called Welcome to Your Dreamtime. It hasn't been published anyways yet. It's the latest thing I wrote.
That's the latest thing you wrote. And you are also, for those who do not know, he's the author of Bug Jack Baron, the famous science fiction novel. And the first science fiction novel I ever read of yours was Agent of Chaos. It had this great cover. I remember that very well. And also wrote a very famous episode of the original Star Trek called The Doomsday Machine, where they never gave you any credit or money for creating the son of the character you created in Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Huh? No, no, no.
I mean,
that stuff is work for hire anyway.
Yeah, I guess so.
I'm not complaining because I made an awful lot of money off that. Nobody expected
Star Trek.
These reruns like this. No. I can't. I have no complaints.
I have no complaints
about that. And also, it was a good creative experience. I mean, That particular working, that was working completely with Gene Roddenberry, and you know,
And what was that like?
It was very good. I have nothing really to complain about it, except the actual Doomsday Machine themselves. And Gene had asked me to design the thing, and I'm not a good artist, but I did. And then when he shows me the thing, I look at it, and I say, Gene, it looks like a windsock dipped in cement. And he says, well, actually, we ran out of money. It is, in fact, a windsock dipped in cement.
Well, there it is. Well, you are tuned to Listener Sponsored Radio, WBAI, 99.5 FM. We're talking to Norman Spinrad. Norman, you have several websites. How can people keep up with what you do?
Oh, boy. I have a website. Oh, you want me to give the URL?
Of course. Boy, please.
Oh, God.
Isn't it normanspinrad@large.com?
No, Norman Spinrad at Large, that's my blog site.
Okay.
The website, which I'm sort of haven't done much with lately, is Norman Spinrad. It's SF.
Go to Norman Spinrad at Large. There are links all over there.
Yeah, well, there are also, if you Google me, all this stuff comes up up front. So I have the website, I have the blog site, and I have a Facebook site.
No, okay. You're on Facebook now.
Yeah, I have a lot of stuff on Facebook. Right. I also have 30 YouTubes, which I made myself.
That's right. I remember those. I remember when you started. Yes.
Yeah, I've got 30 of them. I just made another one.
Oh, okay. Joe?
I've seen those.
You've seen them.
Yes.
You too. So are you going to send a copy of your book to Joe so he can put up a real review? You can trust Joe. He takes risks very well.
Send me your email, and I will send you a copy.
Okay. I'll
send you a copy. DRM. Make sure it's coded.
No, it won't be coded.
I'm kidding.
No, I mean, see, it's code. I am DRMing the stuff I'm selling.
I understand.
I know some people complain about that, but having pirated the pirates myself,
you understand.
I don't trust it.
You can't pirate an old pirated pirate. Well, Norman, I've thoroughly enjoyed talking science fiction with you. And do you have any, like, are you going to be going out with the Dream Book at any time soon?
I don't know yet. But six of the stories have already been published as stories.
Okay.
In Weird Tales and all kinds of places.
And you did get a French publisher to publish Psalm of the Gun.
That's been published, and the paperback is also going to be published shortly. Yeah, I published in French, but not in English. The French publishers also bought Welcome to Your Dreamtime. That's not published yet either. And thus far, we don't have an American publisher that either. We haven't tried as hard as we did with Osama the Gun, because they're not publishing that in France for a couple of years, for about 19 months, as it's already been translated. But they want to be the first to publish.
Okay.
Now they can be, because the French can publish if they really want. Sometimes, I mean, they get the translation finished, they can publish it in 3 months.
Really?
Wow.
Here, nothing gets published in less than a year. It's impossible.
No.
And that's quick.
They need at least 9 months for hype if they're going to do anything. And, all right, this is the last question I have. There's some Italian film that you were one of the creators of?
Italian film?
Some Italian film came out in 2002.
Wow.
You've been credited. Same director who's got a new film out now. The same director of Colombiana that's out right now.
What?
Yes. You're listed as one of the writers.
Are you talking about of what?
It's Red something.
Druids?
No, it's not called Druids.
Sierra Rouge? I don't know anything about this. Wait a minute.
It's an Italian film.
An Italian film?
It's an Italian film, and you're listed in there. Is there another Norman Spinrad?
Like
who's working in film that you didn't know about?
Wow.
Okay, let me just put that Norman Spinrad.
That would be science fiction.
An Italian?
Someone else.
An Italian film. I'll look it up. But in the meantime, we do... We're going to go to music for a minute, and we do have part two of the show. There is an interesting thing that's been going on for a few years called Post-Secret, where you write a secret anonymously, you put it on a postcard, and you...
Where did that come from?
All right, look at that. Wow, look at that. I don't know how that got on there. The computer's up, and I didn't know that it's a Clint Eastwood movie. No, it's a site called Post Secret. It's not a site, but Post Secret. The concept was that he wants you to just write a secret you've never told anybody, put it on a postcard, send it to him. He collected them all up. He's got an exhibit at MoMA right now. He's created an iPhone app. He's having a party right now here in New York. He's launching
In Brooklyn tonight.
And so it's very
interesting. Well, it was last night.
Very interesting social experiment that he's written five bestsellers on. So, you know, I don't even know what to say to that. Okay, so not the Druid King,
That's the most bizarre thing I've ever heard.
Chris, how come you're not on top of this?
Chris, how come you don't know about this?
You know, I deal in postcards, but I don't, you know.
No, not that. We're talking about the whole Norman question here.
What do you want me to do? You want me to look
it up? No, Mike is already on top of it.
I'm on it.
What good are you?
We're going to go to music, and you are tuned to Listener Sponsored Radio, WBAI. Norman Spinrad.
Just for the hell of it, up. Speaking with Frank Warren, who is the creator of something called Post Secret. Frank, welcome to WBAI.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So, tell me, the Post Secret project, tell me first, what inspired you to want to have people send you their secrets on postcards, and what made you think that anybody would even do such a thing?
Yeah, it does sound like a pretty crazy idea, but I was just inspired to pass out blank postcards to strangers and invite them to write down a secret and mail it to me. And I thought if I could really capture people's full honesty, it could be a very special thing or art project or website for me and to share back with everyone else. What I wasn't prepared for is that 6 years later, I'd receive over 500,000 of these postcards anonymously with secrets from all around the world.
Well, it's sort of interesting, and I have to say, because of the nature of the show that I do here, and is, you know, we take calls, it's a late night show, and, you know, people call in, you know, they're anonymous, and we often have themes like this, you know, what is something nobody knows, that kind of thing. And it's interesting how people react and just how much people actually do need to be able to tell the secrets. Now, you have a philosophy that you developed, or a few philosophies, I imagine, that you developed as a result of this. You want to tell me a little bit about that?
Well, I have learned a few things about others and about myself through this project. One of the things I learned about secrets is there are two kinds of secrets, the ones that we keep from others and the secrets that we hide from ourselves. And I think if we can come together with others, anonymously or not, and talk about some of those deeper secrets that we carry within, it can oftentimes inspire other people to share those vulnerable parts of their life, their feelings, their fears, their hopes with themselves and us as well.
Hmm. And so tell me, now, you said you were inspired to give away these cards to total strangers and ask them to send you secrets, and you thought you might, you know, make a website out of it. Was there some impetus for this? Were you just always like a people person? Did you have a lot of secrets? Tell me a little bit about what made Frank Warren the person on earth to do this.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny story because really anybody could have done it. But I was driven to do it. And I think part of it had to do with secrets I was keeping for myself that I needed to face to come to terms with, so I could be a more whole person. I also had a very boring job at the time, so I was inspired to do something creative. And I think there's probably reasons I'll never really know what really had me standing on those street corners handing the cards to strangers. But the project really has turned my life upside down. I sold my business. I focus on secrets now 40 to 50 hours a week. There are books out. There's a Post Secret app. It just continues to grow and expand.
Now, I have to wonder now, I often think that your art defines you as you define your art. And for you now, being the expert on people's secrets, what have you learned about people in general now? And maybe you could define a little better, a secret you keep from yourself. Tell me, describe to me what that is exactly.
I probably travel to 20 to 30 colleges a year and share stories behind the secrets. One of the stories is mine, and probably the part of the my talk that reveals the most about me is about one particular postcard that was mailed to me by somebody I'll never meet. It was a postcard that had a photograph of a damaged bedroom door on it, and the secret said, "My mom beat through my door so she could continue hitting me." And when I saw that picture, it reminded me that when I was in high school, I had one of these damaged bedroom doors too, and I'd never told that secret to anyone. I'd forgotten it for most of my life, but through the courage of this stranger, I was able to find the strength in my own life to face this secret I'd buried long ago. I put it on a postcard, I wrote the secret out, and I mailed it to myself. I have some of my secrets in every book, and this is just one example of how the project has helped me, I think, accept more of who I am and become more whole.
And now you say the secrets that we keep from others. Why do you think, do most people keep secrets because they're ashamed or because they're afraid they'll be judged or because people judge themselves?
I think all of the above. I think we keep secrets from others and sometimes ourselves because they can be painful, they can be offensive, they can make us see a part of ourselves that we'd rather look away from. I feel like secrets are part of this hidden landscape, this reality that we all share and recognize, but we don't necessarily talk about. And with every secret that we uncover, I feel like there's a greater potential to have intimacy with another person and really become more fully accepted and self-actualized as individuals.
And how have you changed as a result of doing this project? I mean, besides the fact that, you know, you're a best-selling author and you own all these businesses now, how have you changed as a person? How has this project helped you?
I've really tried to honor the integrity of the project. So, for example, the post of your website is hits, but I've never taken a dollar for an advertisement on the web. And in other ways, too, I've tried to protect... I've tried to treat every secret with dignity and respect. And I feel like by doing that, the project has led me where it's wanted to go. So there are post-secret books. There's a post-secret art exhibit right now at MoMA as part of the Talk to Me exhibition. And what I'm excited about actually this week is we're releasing the post-secret app. So using your cell phone, a person will be able to take a picture, type in their secret over the picture, connect it to a place, whether it's a city, a state, a school, a coffee shop, and send it out on the web. And then somebody else using the app will be able to search their area for secrets that are of interest to them, and then maybe even reach out and connect to that person and say, you know, I've got an eating disorder too, or this resource helped me, or, you know, sometimes I think the same thing when I see that coffee server at the shop. Whatever it might be, it's a way to take post-secret mobile and kind of grow it exciting new way, and that
post-secret
comes out next
week. Wow. All right, now let me back up a little bit. So the original concept was for people to send you postcard with a secret. Now, do you still do that? You still get the postcards?
Yes. I still invite people to write down a secret on a postcard anonymously, create some art on it, and mail it to my home, and I still get about 100 every day.
And you want to give out the address here for those who are listening?
Sure. It's my home address, right, where I slept last night. It's 13345 Copper Ridge Road, Germantown, Maryland, 20874. And it's easy to find on the web, too. You can just Google post secret or even secret. It comes right up.
And then how do people submit on the website, on postsecret.com?
Well, I prefer that people send postcards, but with the PostSecret app, you'll be able to, I think it's going to cost $1.99, and with that app, you'll be able to submit as many secrets as you want to the community. And they kind of cut me out as a middleman, which I think is another interesting way the project is developing.
Okay. Now, do you feel there's a sort of a catharsis to be actually writing down and taking the time to... Whether you said you were surprised, some people create art, some people have photos, some people would find something that relates to their secret in a postcard. How cathartic do you think that is, and how important do you think that is to being whole, as you say?
Well, that's been one of the biggest surprises for me, is how creative the artwork is on the postcards. And I think in some ways, we can share more of ourselves through through art and images than we can maybe through text. We can kind of communicate it in a way where we don't have to say it, but people will still recognize it and get it. And I'm not a priest or a psychologist, but I have received emails from people who said that searching and finding the right words to take ownership of the secret, and then physically putting it on this tangible card and letting it go to a stranger, has allowed them to see that secret differently, or to maybe be a first step in a much longer journey to face that secret in a way that they've wanted to do for a long time.
Hmm. And the app's going to be called Post Secret, or the Post Secret Project. What will the app be called?
It's going to be called Post Secret, the Post Secret app. I think if you just search for it like that, like postcard, but Post Secret, all one word.
Okay. And you want to give out your address one more time?
Sure. Home address is 13345 Copper Ridge Road, Germantown, Maryland, 20874. And it's super easy to find on the web. Just Google Post Secret, like postcard, Post Secret.
Hmm. And are you able to take any kind of postcard and do something with it? I mean, what do you do with all of the postcards? Do they all end up getting used somewhere?
Well, I think the whole archive is pretty special. I've got over 500,000. And
wow.
I can't use all of them, but I keep them all and I read them all. And sometimes people send me objects other than postcards.
Hmm.
I'm looking at this one right now. This was a secret that was written not on a postcard, but on a Starbucks cup.
Okay.
Flattened the cup, turned it into like a postcard, something mailable, wrote their secret right on the cup, and they wrote, "I give decaf to customers who are rude to me."
I love that.
And another one, this one was sent to me on a photograph of a cat looking up at the camera with a wedding band next to it, and the secret says, "That Saturday when you wondered where I was, well, I was getting your ring. It's in my pocket right now." The guy who mailed me this secret followed up with the rest of the story of how his girlfriend read that, and he popped the question, and she said yes. And so sometimes the sharing of the secret is just the beginning of the story.
Wow, that's great. Well, I get the feeling it's the beginning of your story. And you have the three books. What are the three books?
There's five altogether, and the last one is called Post-Secret Confessions on Life, Death, and God.
Okay. And what are the five books? Can you give me the titles?
The first one's called Post Secret. The next one is called My Secret. Then The Secret Lives of Men and Women, A Lifetime of Secrets, and Post Secret Confessions on Life, Death, and God.
Wow, Frank Warren. Well, you're probably the most unique entrepreneur I've interviewed in the last 10 years. I'll say that.
Well, I appreciate that, but I bet you hear a lot of good secrets yourself.
More than you could possibly imagine.
It's a special position to be in.
Yes, it is. Well, you know what I think? Part of the secret is of the secret of being able to be told secrets, and the way you're doing it, you know, anonymity is definitely part of it, but I also think, but you know, you don't judge, you know, you're just as, you seem to embrace just as negative a secret as positive a secret, because I looked at some of the stuff you had on YouTube, and you've had people tell you things like, you know, "I don't think I'll do anything as well as I do killing people," and that's a secret. But, you know, you'll put that out there just as much as you will something beautiful and special.
Yeah, that one coming from a soldier in Iraq, and I think you're really onto something. You have to be accepting of people's full nature, bad, or people won't share it with you. And also, too, I think it helps to make yourself vulnerable first. You know, it's not every guest of yours, I'm sure, that will get their home address out on your show. I feel
no.
Like when I take that first step in the relationship, others are more likely to trust me.
I agree with you 100%, and hopefully it'll teach people not to judge themselves so much.
I like it.
All right. Frank Warren, I hope I get to have you come back again.
Well, this was a great pleasure. Thank you.
All right, man.
Bye-bye.
So, Chris, is that not one of the more interesting and bizarre things that people are doing here in the world?
It's quite amazing.
You'd be sending that guy a postcard saying, "When you die, I want your postcard."
Well, can
collection.
I tell you something? One of the guys that I just very quickly, one of the guys that I buy postcards from, how he started in the postcard business and being a postcard dealer was he went to a flea market garage, like a garage sale flea market, and this guy had boxes and boxes of postcards.
and he bought like, I don't know, whatever, bought like, I don't know, about 5,000 of them from this guy. And then he went back again and he had sold the cards, and he went back and he bought another 5,000 or 10,000. Where all these postcards came from was that the Price is Right back in the 70s.
Oh, yeah, you
said you used to send in a postcard with what you thought was the winning number was going to be in the prize that someone was going to bid on the item. They were going to put a price in there. So people would mail in the postcards, and then after they would hold on to them for whatever the year, and then they would sell them for paper. And there were people sending postcards all different years and stuff like that, and all different types of postcards, and that's how it all started.
Well, there it is.
I actually knew somebody who used to go and buy whatchamacallit, postage stamps that were like, you know, really not worth anything, mm-hmm. and you could buy it cheaper than what the postage usually cost.
Right.
And then we'd use it to send letters, so you'd get like a letter or a manila envelope with like a gazillion stamps on it to make up the current, like, 2 cents, a penny, you know, that he was getting at bulk prices.
Well, that guy's lifestyle changed with the internet.
People still do that today. They buy old post...
I found a bunch of old stamps in my dad's house.
And they use other things.
Yeah, well, there's so many things. He's got some old stamps. Well, you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI. We were speaking with Norman Spinrad, who is the author of a number of other things, but including Osama the Gun, his latest novel, Doomsday Machine, the teleplay for the Star Trek episode, the original Star Trek, Agent of Chaos.
Deus Ex, He Walked Among Us.
So many, many interesting and counter-revolutionary novels and stories and treatises. And,
Norman was such an you know,
wasn't
innovator.
Wasn't he interesting?
You know, I hope the Doomsday Machine isn't coming.
Exactly. He's great at so many other things. It's like, so now here's the question. And Chris, you may not want to reveal because it's not anonymous. It ties into our theme in the last half hour.
Uh-huh.
What's a secret that nobody knows about you?
Oh, man.
Then it's not a secret.
Well,
how did we know that?
You know, we won't tell anybody.
I'm not.
What's
telling.
The phone number here, Byron? I mean,
Byron. Oh, check, please. Good night, everybody. Let's beat a negative.
I hold him.
Byron, don't be insulted.
Oh.
I didn't say it.
At least I didn't call you Elena.
Oh.
Well, I got enough hair.
You got enough hair, yes. Joe's getting younger. You know, he's been taking the resveratrol.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
No, I didn't, but I'm so honored that Joe's here. I really am, Joe. I'm excited.
212-209-2900.
Best radio.
Death radio.
No,
so did you enjoy the Norman Spinrad there, Chris?
I thought it was great. I really wanted to ask him about, you know, whatever happened to his house in California. That was the he used to live in the original house that was
Peter Lorre's
house. And I thought that was science fiction because he kept saying that, you know, sometimes he heard, you know, kind of weird sounds and he thought the place was haunted.
Hello?
Hey, Mike, how's it going?
Hey.
Who's this?
Buckwheat.
Yeah.
He hasn't seen a movie already, right? 8 years. Yeah, I knew it was you, Buckwheat.
Let me straight. What was that music, the jazz you just played?
This one, the one I was just playing?
It started the show.
At the start of the show, what did I play?
There was that whole thing about the guy saying about going to jazz club.
Oh, jazz. That was on the DGM. You have to get DGM. You have to pledge.
See you?
It's on the DGM collection. It's on 2011 DGM.
Yeah, no. That was talking about a real jazz piece that you played. It was 5 minutes after the show.
Yeah, I know.
Did you play it?
I did. It was DGM. It was a real jazz piece. Like,
are you reviewing it?
It didn't sound like jazz DGM. It didn't sound like that.
No,
what it sound like?
It's DGM, baby.
No, it's like a city kind of jazz, something like that.
City kind of jazz.
Yeah.
City kind of jazz.
City.
Buckwheat, have you seen any? Trailers. Trailers, man.
Trailers. Columbia. I've seen in Columbia. Columbiana.
Columbiana. I saw Columbiana. Yeah. I can give a review of Columbiana.
Yeah, she's hot. Yeah.
And we did find out, by the way, we found out the movie that Norman had worked on. It was a French film, not Italian. Like I said. It was called Red?
No, Mega something.
No, that's Megaton is the director. That's his last name.
Oh, you still want the movie, right?
Yeah, the movie's called Red Siren, and it was directed by...
Megaton?
Megaton, who is the same director, Oliver Megaton.
You're talking about Club Iena, right?
Yes.
She's always... she's hot, man.
Yes, thank
she's
you.
She's hot. What'd you think of the trailer, man?
The trailer.
Yeah, it was good. You know, she looked in a bikini, though. So that's all I call it. She was in a bikini, though.
By the way,
yeah. Did you see Columbiana?
No, but the movie I saw tonight plays directly into the theme.
With the debt?
Yes.
Really? Talk to me.
Because it's about a secret.
Okay.
Basically.
Don't tell me.
No. Basically, it's these three people who were involved in capturing a Nazi war criminal in the 1960s.
The debt.
And. How their actions come back to haunt them and plague them in later life. And it's about a secret and stuff.
How you do with this hurricane?
Very good. Very well done. Helen Mirren, Tom Wilkinson. What's his name? Who was in Terminator Salvation? The young kid. What the heck is his name?
Edward Furlong?
No.
The other one.
The new one. The one that starred opposite... who gives him his heart at the end.
You mean what's the name from Avatar?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, he's in it. And the girl who played the young Helen Mirren character, I can't recall seeing Chastain. Something Chastain is her first name. I think Christy or Jessica Chastain. Very good music. Nice back and forth between past and present, and really liked it. It was good. It was old school kind of thriller.
Well, I'll tell you what I thought of Columbiana.
Yes.
First of all, I like Luc Besson, but he's definitely hit or miss. I mean, I love Taken. I enjoyed the Transporter movies. I can't say they're necessarily good. Second one's better than the first one. The third one
very
is
very pulpy.
The third one was worth your time. But I like the idea. I like the concept. He's always got great concepts. La Femme Nikita, Subway. I liked all those. The Big Blue.
The Professional.
The Professional is probably his best work. And he always has a great concept and great set pieces, but often in search of a good story.
Good cast.
He always has that, but often it's in search of a good story. And Columbiana probably falls into that. There are some great moments in Columbiana, some great scenes. You're completely with it. And about first 10, 15 minutes of the movie, you're like, yes, okay, yes, yes, come on, Luke. And then... A character, the only equivalent I could give is as if you said something to me and then all of a sudden you just doused me in gasoline and lit me on fire. And you say, you see what you made me do? And you just stood there and let me burn, right? And then you just went about your business and you went home.
Well, but it doesn't figure out.
In other words, the
plot doesn't go off on another equally satisfying tangent. It just hits this roadblock.
It's not even a roadblock. It's more like a hole in the plot because the logic is so skewed. It's just not there. It just all for a moment, and it takes you out of the movie. Mm. And then at a certain point, you realize, okay, forget logic. Okay, he's just gonna go for it. And that, I have to say, it hurts it because I want it to make sense. If this were, as he said in the press notes, that he wanted her to see this sort of as what if, Matilda from The Professional had grown up and became an assassin. And he said that this would have been a better movie if it was that sequel.
Character.
And it was that character because then her justification in her becoming that, the idea that she becomes that, I'll buy. You can give me something. But what they give you, and there's some beats in there that...
What they're asking you to
swallow.
Exactly.
It takes you out of the movie. But that being said, it's very enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of fun. I mean, you know, it's movie magic. You know, Zoe Saldana can't be more than 5'3"
mm-hmm.
and maybe 115 pounds soaking wet. But she kicks ass. Men twice your size.
Well, what's his name? You know? Jason Statham is a short guy.
I know. I'm just saying. And movie
basically,
magic.
He said any good director with a great wireman, and you can be your martial arts star.
There it is. And so there's a lot of great sequences, a lot of well staged, clever, smart dialogue, fun. So it's an enjoyable film.
Now, did you see?
Except for these incredible leaps of logic.
Did you see? Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
No, but you said that was good.
I didn't say it was exactly good, but it's got some good acting, some great production design, some good directing. But I think, first of all, Guillermo says,
Chris, buckwheat is gone.
Yeah. It was the scariest. He remembers when he saw the television movie, and it was the scariest thing in the world. Who? Guillermo, in the press notes.
Oh, what? Oh, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark.
Right. Right. You remember that one, Chris, yes?
Yes.
And,
of course.
But pardon me.
I'm sorry.
But I think we'll put our hands up and all agree that the most scariest TV movie ever made was the third episode of...
Trilogy of
Terror.
Of course.
The Devil Doll. That is the scariest.
That is. That's straight
you know
up.
What? People still bring that up.
Yes.
Someone will turn and I'll be somewhere and someone will say, Karen Blair, Trilogy of Terror, because they'll see, I'm out of the show, I'm out of the show and people will see a creepy doll.
Yeah.
And they'll go, that doll looks like, and
dolls
looks
are
like
creepy.
Karen Black.
But, you know, what I, what I think he did wrong here, and if you look at all his other films, except for Blade.
He who?
Guillermo del Toro.
Okay.
He didn't direct this. He wrote this.
He wrote it
and he produced it.
Just like Luke.
And the problem with this is the narrative. Because in all his other films, except for Blade, you meet the character and you are slowly immersed into this other world. You get the whole character set up. You know that there is some trauma and trouble going on in the character's life. And then they're taken to this other level.
Yes.
In this, he starts with a prologue that throws the fantasy at you with the typical Hollywood in-your-face jump moment in the first 15 minutes.
That's why he didn't direct it.
And then, on top of everything else, some really great set pieces, some good acting, some scary moments and stuff. But then he starts to inject... production, like there's a little maze in the garden in the back of the house
for no reason,
and it looks like Pan's Labyrinth, but there's a koi pool in there with these fish, and the
money.
It's like, but they have this thing that has no
bearing on the story,
pertinence to the rest of the narrative. It doesn't, whatever.
It's just and visually.
It
nice.
Is. It is, and if you saw the television movie, what's going to happen. You know, it's just, and then he tries to get clever by calling the character Blackwood, making a reference to Algernon Blackwood, who, wrote the Wendigo and believed in these forces in the forest and ancient spirits. And, he plays some other name games, naming the characters and stuff. But it just, it was great to look at, and I was mildly interested, but I was never emotionally invested. And I don't think it was all that they thought it was going to be. You know what I mean?
Yes.
There were a lot of people behind the film talking the hype, talking the smack. So, there you go. It's a good rental. No reason to go out and pay the money. But did you see Fright Night?
No.
Fright Night. I loved it.
Really?
Loved it.
Loved it.
Loved it.
Make Fright Night without... Somebody said to me the other day, they said, how could they make Fright Night without Roddy McDowell?
Because they updated it.
Well, I know.
Because
that,
it's
that,
not.
But
because
the Roddy McDowell character is minor now.
But no, he's not. Not in this.
No, he's a minor character now.
He's not.
He's not?
No. And in fact, there's a whole big twist in it, which I don't want to give away. But what I really liked is, you're looking at a contemporary situation when there are no more horror hosts. How do you turn around?
There are no more horror hosts.
There aren't. There's no more creature features.
Oh, yeah.
So how do you turn around and create the Peter Vincent vampire killer? And.
They come up. Don't tell me what they do.
Well,
don't tell me what they do. Don't tell me.
He's a Chris Angel character.
What, you see, you told me what they do.
But that's not telling you the context of everything. And they
didn't you just hear me say, "Don't tell me what they do."
And they center it around.
And he just tells me.
And they center it around Vegas. And they take advantage of a lot of things in the current zeitgeist with the economy and alienation.
Now there's no surprises.
Oh, there are tons of surprises.
You ruined it.
I liked it. And. This was the first 3D movie I saw this summer that went back to old school, in your face 3D gotchas.
Like they used to do in Second City? Like, all right, go ahead.
You know, like the faces coming out of the screen and the shooting crossbow arrows coming out of the screen. And there's a really, really great effect in the movie that is totally unexpected. And everybody in the audience went, whoa! And Chris Sarandon has a cameo in it.
Why are you telling me all of this?
Because it's in the pictures. Everybody's
not in the pictures.
I'm not telling you what his cameo is.
Give me a review.
He shows up. He was great.
Don't tell me the plot.
He was great. Everybody in the audience was applauding, and I even applauded myself at the end. I left the theater.
This is website spoiler joke.
No, it's not. It's not a spoiler.
I'm spoiler joke.
His picture was in the press notes.
They ran it in the paper.
You know who else is in it?
There you go.
Yes,
and
correct.
Just so there's no surprise,
Morgan Fairchild is in it. There
twist
you go.
Is,
Morgan Fairchild is in it.
And special guest star.
There you go. And I left.
Uncredited for those who
exactly.
didn't
I'm not
know
that.
From me.
And
now you know.
Lloyd is in it.
But I left the theater. My cheeks hurt. I was smiling so much. I had a good time with it.
Wow.
You left the feeler. That's a quote.
I left it.
I cheeks, smiled so much. My cheeks hurt.
There was so Joe many. Missouri there was so many little time. Things. It was just
that's
like.
Great. That's a good quote.
It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it.
I'm going to use that quote, Joe. All right.
So who else is here? Who's else is here besides Chris?
Yes, listen.
Yes.
Can I say something?
Please.
There was a lot more controversy with Columbiana than anyone.
Well, okay. Can I say more? Let me finish my review of Columbiana.
Okay.
The other thing about Columbiana, I got to say, because I don't think there's one Colombian in the movie, okay? And they got the guy who plays Columbiana's father. It's like, okay, the guy is like, maybe he's half Mexican, half Arab or something. I don't know what he is, okay? But let
wasn't
me tell
Danny Trejo?
Let me tell you something. He didn't go to Colombia and learn an accent. He watched and rented Scarface, right? And he just does Scarface accent. And he just
say hello to my little friend.
It's like every actor who grew up in that it loves to one day have to do it. He's like, hey, well, you know, Colombiana. You know, it's like he just does that. So I mean, you know, come on. I know Zoe's not Colombian. I know that, I don't think, and then I start to wonder, okay, now, and then just Al Pacino just inked another film where he's going to play who is it? He's playing the Colombian real leader.
He's not playing Che Guevara.
No, come on. Come on.
Well, it's like John Travolta.
But anyway, it doesn't matter. He's played a Colombian like three times. But here's my question. Are there no good Colombian actors? Do they just not exist?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just one of those things. You do wonder as you're watching a movie when you're like, this guy, you know, he does not look any kind of Colombian.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So, anyway.
Yeah,
I mean,
but yeah, this is something, and it's something else. When she
what? Talk to me.
I understand that this is what I heard from Colombian actors.
Colombian, right? Yeah, I'd love to have some Colombians. What do you think?
They were basically saying that that she was referring to the people who were making these criticisms, saying that they were stupid or idiot.
Who was saying? What are you talking about?
The young actress.
Oh, I have an interview with her. I interviewed her.
And also, they I'm also said
Wednesday.
that when this movie was sent to other countries, it wasn't even called Colombian. It was called something else. It was titled differently.
Of course it's not
going
to become. Because Colombiana sounds exotic in America.
There you go. And in
right?
Colombia, they called it Americana. Americana.
Right. It's like no one in the movie is the
there
race
you go.
That they are. You know? So there it is. Hello, you're on the air.
In France, they probably called it Puerto Ricana.
Hello, you're on the air. Puerto Ricana.
Yeah.
New Ricana. Hello, you're on the air.
Sugar and spice and everything hot.
Get
you know, Matilda does grow up. She becomes a ballerina.
Hello, you're on the air.
That's yeah, I just want to say regarding accents, if someone is native-born Colombian, are you going to expect them to speak English? And if someone's Colombian-American, they're not going to sound Colombian either.
So they're going to sound like Al Pacino?
Well, but, you know, the thing is, everybody from Latin American countries is going to speak English slightly differently, and the nuances of that are sometimes almost are very difficult to pick up and to recreate.
So are you excusing Pacino's accent,
well,
or you're
no,
saying it's
I mean,
authentic?
Pacino, well, Pacino touches me personally. I'm Cuban-American, for want of a better term, and what he does in Scarface is laughable and almost hysterically funny.
Well, that's what this actor does. He does, like, sort of a weakened version of that.
Yeah. Well, you see, that's the thing. A lot of people don't realize that there's so many subtleties and nuances between the way...
Well, let me just say, people would never know it from seeing any of these movies featuring Colombians, quote-unquote. They would
but
never know what Colombians
are. Mike, the difference...
Yeah, I'm listening.
...speaking Colombian and someone who's a Colombian-American or a Cuban-American, all those things cut different ways. So, you know, how can you expect people to know where to go with that to please everybody?
You know, I'm not saying that they could know where it is at to go with please that appease everybody. And if you're an actor, it's up to you to do your homework and decide, like, what accent you want to do, what region. I'm sure if you go, just like in America, you go to different parts of America, people speak with different variations
well,
on
exactly.
an American
yeah,
accent.
They're...
That's true of all across the planet. But I think he could have gone anywhere and taken any version of dialect that didn't necessarily sound like Al Pacino in Scarface. That's all I'm saying.
Well, that's true. That's a big difference there.
Now let me ask you a question.
There's a big difference between Costeño, the coast people, and the interior people who are like in the mountains. So it's all, and all people who are rural, people who are educated.
Yes.
Somehow people have this whole notion that there's this one big Hispanic, everybody speaks the same way.
America has very weird prejudices. Americans think people who speak second languages are stupid when they're actually speaking a second language. You know what I'm saying? So that's just a weird American thing. But I have a question for you, Sarah. I'd like you to give yourself a fake name and tell me a secret that nobody knows about you.
Oh, my goodness.
That's right, because nobody knows who you are. You can give yourself a fake name right now. Call yourself Joe Spoiler.
How about Damien?
Damien. Love
Damien,
it.
Damien, there you Antichrist.
So, Damien.
No, Steppenwolf, Damien.
Damien Steppenwolf. That's a good name.
That's more benign Damien.
That's good. That's
okay, something nobody knows about me?
Yes. No, a secret that's your secret.
A secret that nobody knows about you.
No one knows. You've never told anybody the secret.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, come on now, Damien. Damien Steppenwolf.
Sometimes I wish I could be a character in a Hermann Hesse novel and live in 1920s Germany. How about that?
Okay. All right. That's pretty good.
Wow.
That's pretty good.
Wow. That's heavy,
before
man.
Got crazy over there. Right?
I'm with you. All right. I like that. That's a good one.
And you want to work in a cabaret like in Cabaret?
Exactly.
No, that's a little too freaky.
No,
okay.
I wish someone would make Steppenwolf into a film. That would be hell of a film.
Yeah, that would, but that's not going to be an American. Hello, you're on the air. Hello?
I'm still here.
No, I know you're still there, but I brought somebody else in.
Yeah, I'll be gone, guys.
What about your secret name, Dolores?
What's the phone number here, Joe?
212-209.
Is that your secret name, Mike? Dolores?
Yeah, that's my secret name.
Where did that come from?
Who knows? Like, where did the stuff that goes through your mind come from?
Don't get me involved. I'm not sharing my secret.
Listen, Lulu.
Shut up, Lulu. 212. You say with authority. Like,
I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
212-209-2900. Tell us your secret and you can use any name you want. Yes. Hello, you're on the air.
We need to hear from Buckwheat. We need a secret from Buckwheat.
No, please.
His secret is that he hasn't
seen a movie. We don't have that much time left
Buckwheat
in the show.
Buckwheat admitted it the other day. He hasn't seen a movie in 8 years. So it's really just about trailers. He's straight up. That was his secret. Cool. Hello, you're on the air. Hello? Okay, playing possum. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, of course.
Yes. And
yeah. Okay.
Yes, give me a secret, sir.
Yeah. Absolutely.
This is not 311.
You didn't think
you'd not reach
through the
mayor's office.
You didn't think you'd get through, did you?
Yes.
You weren't prepared.
You just decided just to call find out what was going on.
Totally prepared.
He's been taken
Come on.
Back.
Indeed, tell us indeed. A secret. Tell us a secret and give us a fake name.
Yeah, fake name?
You repeat along.
Let's see. How about...
Don't take too much time now.
Hetz. How's that?
What? Hetz?
Fake name.
What's the name?
Hetheru.
Okay. Hetheru.
Yeah.
All right, Hetheru, tell us a secret about yourself that no one knows.
Yeah, secret about myself is that I find Monroe to be incredibly funny.
Okay. You love it when
hey, Monroe, why haven't you called the radio station yet, man? Wake up.
That's a new secret. medicine,
you don't want to share.
Oh, because he doesn't have any power. Monroe's power is out.
Hello, you're on the air. Hello? Hello?
Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Hello?
Are you there?
What's the phone number, Joe?
212-209-2900.
Hello, you're on the air. Do you have a secret?
I figured the lines would be just
the
lit
people
up.
Are just calling and not realizing they're being picked up, and they're still on hold. Hello?
I really dig you, Dolores.
This is stupid, though. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Joe.
Joe. All right, tell us your secret, Joe.
I never got my DGMs.
Get out
of here. Not really a secret.
You know, Vlad, don't even try it.
They now have a special department for that, Vlad.
What's the department?
I even sent a pic of the CD they did send me to Mike, and I still didn't get it. They sent me this bizarre...
Oh, that's right. You did. Yes, you did. They sent you the wrong CD. Okay.
Yeah.
Son.
What, they sent you the secret one?
Yeah.
It was a secret.
Mike's secret CD, only for special.
Hey, Joe, what's going on?
Not much. You try to play it backwards?
Exactly.
Friday Night was good, actually.
You liked it?
Yeah. I was one of those in the theater that we were like, wow, this is actually good.
It was. Very well cast. Very well directed.
Alan Farrell was actually good.
I will watch the DVD.
Now, you the 3D, was the 3D a lot of fun or what?
No, I don't see 3D.
Oh, okay. But
it's something like Avatar.
It's beneath. It's beneath him.
I like the 3D. I thought it was, because like, that
one, I know the scene you're talking about.
That was so great in CD because it was so unexpected and it was so in your face.
CD?
What scene was that?
I'm not telling
you. The one with the stripper,
exactly,
right?
The one he's going to talk
stripper,
about.
Stripper, yeah.
Look,
yeah.
There it is. They're going to try to spoil it.
No, it's a stripper.
No, but
you two cut from
you
the
can
same
just imagine.
It does come unexpected.
Well, not now. Hello, you're in the air.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm
Buck,
from the Bronx,
the Ghost Rider trailer looks amazing.
Right.
Well, we'll see. The first one was pretty, like...
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. But the second one looks amazing.
So Nicolas Cage has got to get his medicine therapy together.
Well, you know, if he just has the proper wig, it's a good movie. Hello, you're in the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, it's Tom from the Bronx here.
No, you can use
Mr.
the fake
movie
name,
phone.
Tom.
And I like to be WBAI manager for a month. Radio manager.
Well, I bet if you pledged $15,000, they'd let you do it.
Just for a month?
Well, probably for a day.
Oh, for a day?
Well, half a month.
Half a month.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe
$5,000. Anyway, but it's not going to happen. So
well, if you got that money, you know, I can work something up. So
yeah,
do you have a secret?
Because
Joe has a story. Joe, you tell us a story while he thinks about a secret.
What story am I going to tell you? Oh, story.
Story, what are the stories? Come on, you have some good ones there.
I
Pick
do?
Something. You had a couple good ones, I thought.
We got the last 5 minutes, guys.
That's right. Come on, Joe. Hurry.
Ferry runs aground. Actually, I should read the titles. And
read the titles. That's good.
Ferry runs a... Ferry.
Ferry.
Ferry runs aground after captain stuck in toilet.
Okay.
Greased devil panic grips rural Sri Lanka. This one is an old one.
Which?
Gerard Depardieu outrages passengers by urinating in plane.
That was a week ago.
That was
what?
More than that, yes.
Yeah, Gerard Depardieu, he peed in the plane.
Zoo animals predicted earthquake, yes. And spider silk.
Now, that's the one. Read the spider silk. This
yeah,
is
I
fantastic.
Knew this.
You knew nothing.
They had a thing on the Animal Planet about this.
All right, well, it wasn't covered here on Night Shift.
So. All right, read that one, Joe.
Bulletproof skin. May sound like something from a science fiction movie.
Yeah.
But, with the help of researchers who genetically modified goats and silkworms to produce spider silk, I saw the thing with the goats. Actually, it was pretty creepy because they milked the goats and then they were straining the milk and they were pulling spider silk out of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is just...
I saw that too.
Life
no?
is like science fiction. That's just...
That was like creepy. Imagine getting spider silk in your milk.
No. That sounds like a country song.
I milk my goat.
Spider silk.
And got spider silk in my milk.
All right, we got 4 minutes. Go ahead.
Dutch artist Jacala Iskati
Jacala.
Has made it a reality to make
Jacala.
The skin.
That's a name for
She
your
grafted
child.
Silk from.
Let us name him Jacala.
Transgenic silkworms between two layers of human skin.
Transgenic silkworms?
Yes, the epidermis.
That's
and dermis.
For a band.
When bullets were fired at the material.
Transgenic silkworm.
At reduced speeds. Notice reduced speeds. Mm. So they're firing the bullets at reduced speeds.
Yes.
So they're not even like regular speed.
Yeah, but they got
to
see.
They were unable to pierce it. Mm. Well, the researchers producing the silk, more exciting than the silk's ability to repel bullets, is the potential use as grafting material for larger wounds.
Heard it here first.
It
just milk a goat on my skin and my wound heals. It's a miracle.
Milk. Spider silk milk.
Spider silk milk.
Heard it here first.
There it is.
There.
There's just a couple of headlines. The blue headlines
and
you can read.
Just right next to the Harry Nevis.
The Harry Nevis. And you are tuned to Listen Sponsored Radio, WBI. You should go on Facebook and like us, NITESHIFT. There's some other night shift out there now. Somebody's trying to steal our thunder. But go on Facebook. Make sure you know it's us. Just any of the titles that grab you, Joe.
Llamas excel at dog training school and learn to fetch and roll over.
There it is.
Happy Feet, the wandering penguin heading home.
Oh, where's he heading?
I have no. Muammar Gaddafi's secret photo album of Gondolas Richie Gandulis and Rice discovered. Sorry.
What? Gandule, what? Listen,
mosquitoes disappearing in some parts of Africa.
In Texas, too.
Yes.
Yeah. You know why? Because they use genetically modified mosquitoes that...
Well, no, here's, check this out. This whole story sounds science fiction. Malaria-carrying mosquitoes are disappearing in some parts of Africa, but scientists are unsure as to why. Figures indicate controls such as anti-mosquito bed nets having a significant impact on the incidence of malaria in some sub-Saharan countries. But in Malaria Journal... Interesting that there is a magazine. Researchers say that mosquitoes are also disappearing from areas with few controls. They are uncertain if mosquitoes are being eradicated or whether they will return with renewed vigor. Data from countries such as Tanzania, Eritrea, Rwanda, Kenya, and Zambia all indicate that the incidence of malaria is dropping fast. Researchers believe this is due to the effective implementation of control programs, especially the deployment of bed nets. But a team of Danish and Tanzanian scientists say this is not the whole story. For the past 10 years, they have been collecting and counting numbers of mosquitoes and caught in thousands of traps. They said in 2004, they caught 5,000. 5,000. In 2019, it dropped to 14.
2019.
That's right. No, in 2009, it dropped to 14. Joe was talking over me. In 2004, they caught 5,000. In 2009, they caught 14. So, I'd say that's quite a drop. Quite a drop. Are we ready for Jimmy Dore?
Of course we are.
Okay, well, Jimmy Dore is coming.
Here comes Jimmy.
Wait, let's get a secret from...